heads to the front here in Mugello. Has he timed this to absolute perfection? Asking major, major question. The two Ducatis, oh, all three of them almost have contact.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This episode number 606. I'm one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy, and to join me to talk the MotoGP from Mugello is none other than Jim McDowell. Jim, how's it going?
It's going good. We were in the rolling hills of Tuscany at probably the best MotoGP track on the calendar, Mugello. It did not disappoint. And you're going to be there soon, aren't you, Skyler? In Italy, that is?
I will be in Italy, and I have to say I really messed up. I should have went about 2 weeks earlier and could have caught this. Well, because I'm going to be in Tuscany for like a week, so I definitely could have slid on over to catch Mugello. But one of our friends here was pregnant. My wife was signed up to help her, so we couldn't really make that happen. But regardless, it's going to work out. But a little bummed that I didn't get to make it out in time for that race, because, man, what a race that would have been to go to.
Well, it would have been a fantastic weekend. That everything was good for Mugello. The weather was beautiful. The track was great. The racing was good. Really not too much to complain about if you're a fan of motorcycle racing.
Absolutely not. I mean, the weather was fantastic. It was that perfect where it's like really warm, but it's not deathly hot, so the bikes can get out there and really push it and get as much grip as they want from the track. And there's nothing better, I think, than when they bring the helicopter view over the top of the mountains there and drop down into the Mugello track, that little valley. It's one of the most beautiful shots they do through the whole MotoGP season.
Yeah.
It's definitely a bucket list track, that is for sure.
Definitely. I think also it's one of the tracks that's kind of pure still. There's not the ubiquitous stop, start, really
not a Herman Tilke track.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a Tilke track. And it's just, it looks like, from the onboard shots, you have great elevation change, great challenging corners, and I think you could really easily get into a flow and a rhythm on that circuit, which is what you really want in a motorcycle. You want that flow and that rhythm.
You do. Now, we got to get things started off right here on this Tuesday afternoon. Oh, wait, no, Monday night. Wow, actually
Monday
recording
night.
On schedule. Weird. Anyway, here we go. Oh, yeah.
That does sound good.
Today's Dumb Opinions of Skyler, brought to you by Hermitage Brewing Company. They're actually local here in San Jose, California. I just discovered some of their beers, and I'm drinking the Keithy Hyde Scotch Ale. So we'll see how loose things get in about 30 minutes or so.
I have my stopwatch started for your lap time, sir.
Yep. Nope. I'm sure I'll be editing stuff out just like last time.
Not yet. How's it taste?
You know, it's not bad as far as Scotch Ales go. It's a little strange. It has some bitterness to it, which isn't normal for Scotch Ales, but it definitely got the flatness correct. It's getting there. I say they still got some work to do, but not bad.
Okay.
Not bad. But anywho, Jim, we have donators who donated to our show, and we must thank them. Thank you, you super cool, awesome, freaking friends. I do not have an updated list, so I'll have to get back to that. But you know who you are. We appreciate it. Every bit that is donated to the show goes back. It gets us out to races, just like when it got Dave out to the races. He got those lovely interviews for us. It gets us out when they get to our local tracks locally, like when Scott Bolton gets out there, or myself at Sonoma or Laguna, wherever it is. And it just helps keep the show on trucking with website fees, blah, blah, blah. So thank you very much to all you donators and subscribers. Remember, folks, if you want to be a donator or subscriber, just like those lovely people, you can head over to our page at motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side, you will see two donate buttons there in gold. One is for subscription, one is for donation. Choose whichever, donate however much little or however much or as little as you would like. If PayPal is not your thing, head over to Patreon. That's patreon.com/motopod if that's more your speed. Every penny does help, so we do appreciate it. Now, that's enough pandering from me, as usual. We don't have any listener feedback. Listeners, where are you at? Where are the opinions? We have not seen them. We want to hear from you. Write us in. Tell us your favorite moment from this weekend or this season, or your favorite rider, or why Skyler and Jim are always so very wrong when they have to go back a whole 7 months into MotoGP history. Got me. Write us in. Tell us what you think of the show, how it's been going. You got to give us feedback so we know what to do for you. Jim, not a lot of news this week, was there?
No, not. The news is really the racing, but it does look like that Jack Miller took a few laps on the new V4R Panigale, so that'd be fun to do.
He popped out there during the Moto2, Moto3 test they had at Barcelona last weekend, or the week before, maybe. Anyway, he got there, spun a few laps, and of course everyone's like, oh man, is Jack going to make a switch? Chill out! Jack just wanted to get some time on the track and get some more, kind of like when Rossi throws his leg over the R1 and runs around Misano with his VR46 guys. He's just out there having fun on a bike. Jack's whole comment is like, hey, the thing still had a horn. I'm not testing. I'm just riding, just trying to get a feel for things.
You know, speaking of Miller, the Pramac boys were in their Lamborghini colors, the yellow and black. I thought those bikes looked good.
Oh, they did.
Oh, they were sweet. Definitely sweet.
Yeah, absolutely. I always love Mugello. It brings out special colors. And Rossi was kind of saying, it's like, oh, wouldn't Mugello is kind of like the Monaco of MotoGP? Maybe getting there. I think that's maybe like as far as excitement, and it's kind of right there at the beginning of summer and everyone's still in the fight. I could kind of see that, but the glitz and glamour is not quite there. But maybe. I definitely the crowd turnout for sure. I mean, what'd they have on Sunday? Didn't they say they
85,000.
Packed in there too. Not a blade of grass in between them. That was amazing. Dude, so Dovizioso, much like the aforementioned Rossi there, is going to be doing some testing with four wheels. He's going to jump into a DTM car this coming weekend and spin some laps. And, you know, maybe he is setting himself up for a bit of what to do after MotoGP, or much like Rossi in the Formula One car or Casey Stoner in the Super V8, just out there to have a little bit of fun. Although Stoner did pursue it for a little while. He went over there and raced, I think, in their, like, what would be, like, considered, what would, like, the Busch series, the one step down.
I think he did.
I think he did some good testing, but when it came out to the racing, he kind of was like, eh. And then he was like, oh, okay, I'm not going to spend more time or money, and went on about his way. But I don't know. It'd be interesting to see what Dovi does in a DTM. I mean, that's pretty much your next step down from Formula One. Those things are gnarly.
They're pretty well filed developed. I guess he's going to drive an Audi in that, right? Because the parent company of Ducati, or they own Ducati or whatever. But that would be interesting if he's in one of those R10s, because those are some bad little cars, man.
But, dude, they yeah. are. Mm. All right, now, speaking of development.
Or lack of.
Man, Aleix Espargaró. He's a pretty reserved guy, I would say, as far as when he comes out and talks. He definitely wears his emotions on his sleeve when he's on the track. But he did not have the greatest of things to say about Aprilia this week and the development rate that they're going at. He even compared it against his brother's team. Of course, that's Pol Espargaró we're talking about. With KTM, how they went out, did a test, came back and got a top 10. And he said, yeah, we haven't had new parts since last year. This is a 20s, he said, what I think he said, like a 17.2. He didn't even call it an 18.2. He was saying they're that far back in development. They're not getting faster, and his frustration is growing higher and higher. And then his teammate kind of threw him under the bus prior in another interview and said that Aleix Espargaró was not a good development rider, which I think Ian Ono might put his foot in his own mouth a little bit, because every bike I've seen Espargaró get on has gotten better when he's on the team.
Yeah, that's a true statement by you. That's a little, well, not, I always wondered how this was going to work between Espargaró and Iannone, because you'd have the, you know, sort of a hot-headed Italian on an Italian team, and if things weren't going to go right, you knew that it was going to be handbags at dawn, and I guess we've reached that point right now. So the infighting might be more fun to watch than some of the races, but that's sad. You know, Aprilia is just a small factory. They don't have the Red Bull money that KTM has. They don't have the money and the development staff that HRC has. They don't have they used to have Gigi Delegna, but, you know, I guess when you're him and you're that good and you have somebody like Philip Morris says, here is our checkbook, please write yourself a salary to come join us, you're not really going to hold on to that guy. So you've got to kind of come up with a way to work the smarter, not the harder. And I think it's better for them to maybe take a few more races and truly develop parts and pieces that are really going to help them, as a opposed to spending lots of money to make a new chassis or a new swing carbon fiber swing arm that isn't going to give them what they actually need to go faster. And they need to probably really try to focus on what they can get and bang for the buck. If the motor is really the one part that's lacking in, say, acceleration, they need to work on that and concentrate their efforts there to get it, the motor working as best that they can. Of course, that's going to cause the chassis to go off, but then you've got to work through that part of it. So,
you know, that's one thing I was going to actually ask you, and I'm glad you mentioned it because I don't have the greatest of grasp on that. Can you explain maybe a little further into depth how when you go up in top speed, so essentially you've got more horsepower of the engine, and let's say you've made a significant jump, you've gained 10 mile per hour on the back end of 180, which is a considerable amount without gearing, how that affects your chassis as far as now its cornering ability and so forth? Because it definitely does, but how?
I don't think it's the idea that you've gained top speed that's the real issue to the chassis. I think it's if you have created a bike that can accelerate faster. So as you open that throttle up, if you have a bike that can accelerate better, that means you're going to have more grip. And when you got more grip, you have more grip until the tire gives up on you. And then the chassis will start to go away. Well, it's that combination of, you know, a nice grip, soft grippy tire with this really hard acceleration that's going to cause that chassis to want to flex, because the tire is going to bite into the track and it's going to start to want to wiggle around on there if it isn't rigid enough. And then you've got that problem that then magnifies itself as you continue down that straightaway into, you know, the big head shakes and the wobbles. And you remember the 1 year, was it Marquez or Pedrosa on the Honda? It was shaking so bad it would knock their feet off the pegs. So you have to look at how do you fix that problem. And then the second part of that problem is not the top speed that you've obtained again. It's the now I need to brake from, instead of what's called 180, now I got to start braking from 190. But I'm going to want to do that at the same spot that I did previously because I can't give up anything on the brakes going into the corner. So now I'm pulling on this harder. So I'm got a lot more force going through the front tire, which means there's a lot more load now being transferred through the front forks to the suspension. So it's going to want to try to bottom out sooner. So you've got to work on stiffening the front forks up or riding with stiffer springs. But that potentially becomes a problem because now I don't have the feel of the edge grip or the entry corner feel on the tire because I've got a stiffer spring. So it kind of starts to magnify itself into a weird Rubik's Cube that you do one thing and now you've got to fix the other things because it's all a knock-on effect because you're not comfortable now as a rider to be able to go faster given the new motor that accelerates harder, if any of that made any sense at all.
No, I definitely, you know, it does make sense. It sounds like it's really hard and engineers should get paid a lot of money. I think they do, actually. So
they do.
All right, cool. Well, that's it. That was we actually extended out the news farther than I thought we would. So congratulations, Jim. We did it. We ran on again like we normally do. So anyway, let's just shoot through some qualifying because, you know, Moto3 and MotoGP are probably going to take up a significant amount of time for the stuff we want to talk about. So let's get through qualifying, get to the race, and boom, sure. Boom, boom.
So
qualifying. Did you watch qualifying? Because I'm horrible at qualifying now. I'm so busy. I tend to miss it.
I will have to admit to missing Moto2. Somehow I just blanked out on that whole thing. But I did see Moto3 and MotoGP. I guess I must have just zoned out because you see qualifying as Moto3, MotoGP. And I'm like, oh, it's now 10 o'clock in the morning. I got to go do stuff on Saturday. So I sort of forgot about watching Moto2. But Moto3. So from the first qualifying session, Fernandez, Ramirez, Brad Binder, and Migno all advanced to go into the Q2 session. The Q2 session was going to be about the slipstream. It was because they were talking about you get upwards of like a half of a second by being in that slipstream. So it was you're waiting for something to really happen in that session. Everyone's putting down lap times, but everyone's got sort of trying to find a dance partner. There was a lot of guys that were all over the racing line. Some were putting, some weren't, and some guys are trying to fly around. It was I expected there to be a whole lot more penalties for riding on the racing line than what there were. But the interesting thing was, as the time wound down and all this talk about having to have a slipstream, here came Rodriguez, and he put in a cracking lap with no help from anybody in a slipstream. And it was like, wow, where'd this come from? How'd this happen? It's like, well, that's what's going to happen when you are forced to be in a 15-minute time zone. You're going to get out there, put your head down, and just run the wheels off your motorcycle to try to qualify as best you can. And that's what Rodrigo did. So you're kind of in this wait-and-see mode, because who is there somebody going to get this right where they've got their timing and they got a draft and they got a buddy and you're looking? And then, you know, Antonelli was there. He was second, so he was just gotten beaten for to pole, but he pulled into the pits with a couple minutes left to go, which was strange. So he was going to wait this out in the pits. So, well, how far was he going to fall down the list, because he was second to Rodrigo. And then suddenly we had the strange case of John McPhee, who didn't go out until there was about 5 minutes left in the session. That was the first time he touched the track, which I could not imagine why he didn't want to go out and at least get a banker lap or try to get in the toe of some people, because everybody's on the track and the track always changes because you're adding rubber to it, and he didn't have any knowledge about that. Yet he goes out there, and then he was, you know, it's hands up, and he's sort of moaning and complaining that everyone's sort of in his way. And well, that's what you get for sitting in the pitch. You got to come put a lap out. But at the very end, what happened was that Arbolino did it perfectly to get to the top. He got a draft. It pipped Rodrigo, who remained in second. And then he was followed by Delaporte, who came screaming through for third. Then Minho came through, who came out of the first session to be fourth, which was pretty impressive. Suzuki was fifth. Then Antonelli, who was second and waiting it out in the pits, fell to sixth, with Fanati seventh, Toba eighth, Ramirez ninth, and Kennett snuck in there for tenth. And if you look at it, it was top three bikes were all Honda, 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 KTM, then Honda, 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 KTM. So it was definitely, if it's a horsepower track, the Hondas definitely have that figured out. They were looking very strong in the Moto3 class.
Yeah, and as important qualifying is at some tracks,
not here.
This is probably not one of them, because when they come around that first, the first time they come on the last corner, they get onto the straightaway, the draft fest is insane. And of course, Moto3 this year was no different. So we get to the race, and we had our first follow was Misaki. He went down on the first lap. It was kind of a bummer. McPhee. Now, this guy qualified in 18th place, and somehow, I had to go back and watch it, pulls up like 9 places in the first 2 corners. Like, dude, that was
impressive.
And then, of course, yeah, we get to the first time they come around in this slipstream city. This is probably the best track. Qatar is pretty good too, but just because of the way that last corner winds them up, it doesn't really slow them down. It really is like pulling the band back on the slingshot or the bow right before you release them down the straightaway. And man, we're talking like 8 abreast going down that straightaway. That is nuts, mm-hmm. Man.
Yep. It was some fascinating stuff to watch. I think it's always amazing to me that these guys are pretty much kids. I think 21, there's an age limit to Moto 3 still, isn't there? Like, you can't be older than like 22 or something, or do they ditch that?
I feel like 22. No, I think 22 or 23. I think that's what Efren Vasquez ran into a couple years back, where he had been in the Moto 3 and 125s forever, and eventually he's kind of came up against that. I think he dabbled in the Moto 2 for a little bit, and it wasn't his thing, and kind of bounced and kind of ruffled his feathers a bit, because that's, you know, the consequence of, you know, everyone has a ceiling, right? And his ceiling was Moto 3 or 125. So he was built for that. That's where he was comfortable. That's where he was fastest, where he could make his money. And his age took him out, not his skills. So he had an argument there. It'd be like saying Kenny Safoglu in the 600 Supersport, like, hey, man, you've been here too many years. You got to go. It's like, well, Superbike's not his thing. 600s are, and he makes his money over there. Now you're taking that job away from that guy. I could also see it on the other hand where this is a development series. This isn't like, you want to do that, go race somewhere else. We want to bring up the talent through here. It's a business the way it works.
But to the point I wanted to make was, I'm always amazed that these are kids, basically. They're 19, 20-year-old kids, and they run that close together that fast, and you really don't see that many problems. Now, we did almost see Suzuki high side to the moon because he came out of that last corner, and I don't know if it was the paint was a little slick there or exactly what happened, but that was a close one. He was out of the seat for sure, but he held on to it. And then we had Rodrigo had started to drop down the list from the lead group, and he went from the front to the last spot of the train, which was about the top seven were pretty much together, and they had a little bit of a break. Brad Binder had moved up with another, you know, him, McPhee, De La Porta all sort of kind of ran to the front and made great moves for that as well. But then,
De La Porta, man, he's did something that's almost impossible in Moto 3. He pulled a gap. Like, he had a good, like, 12 bike gap for a while. The way he got out of that last corner was amazing. I don't know how. I don't think I've ever seen in the small bike class anyone get out and stay out front on the straightaway at Mugello since I've been watching.
That was impressive by De La Porta. He had that last section of track just hooked up. And if you didn't believe it, De La Porta made a mistake, I think, going into one, somewhere with about half the race gone. And literally, he's now back to the end of the train, so he's fifth. They go roaming around, they get to the last turn, and he passes all five bikes going into the last turn and still out-accelerated everybody off that turn. It is probably one of the best passes I have seen in a very, very long time. He did it right.
And the best part about it, it was clean. He didn't touch anybody. He didn't lift anybody. He just fired it through and just gone.
And he was like there to the very inside. He was near the grass. And everybody sort of kind of takes a bit of a wider entry to try to maximize the length of the straightaway. Because the old saying is, if you can late apex as early as possible, you now create the longest straightaway possible. And he didn't have that opportunity and still just carried massive corner speed. I mean, his feel on the front was incredible. He knew exactly how much to give that bike and how much lean he had and how much edge grip he had, and just rode in there. And quite honestly, he made the top four guys in front of him really look stupid almost, because it was so, like you said, he was clean. He didn't sit anybody up. There wasn't a surprise. It was just vroom. And he was through, which was just an incredible piece of riding at that point for it.
Yeah, his breaking point there looked about 10 meters later than anybody else that went in that corner. And just, he had that perfect inside line where it seemed like as they were breaking and kind of doing that thing where you kind of wash out to make the corner a little bit wider then cut it back down, he just stuck in the middle. And you would think like, oh, he's going to fire it, and then probably one run wide as they're straightening out, and he was accelerating as they were coming back already. I mean, yeah, he definitely has that corner down at that track better than anybody else on there. But there was some dramas at that after that. They kind of, you know, at that point, they were still mixing around. There was no dull point in this race, but this is definitely when the top guys were starting to spread it just a little bit, and some of the guys who maybe were in that like 7th, 8th kind of place weren't really keeping up with the front runners
But at this point in the race is two things for me. One, Toba was like down in 11th with like 7 laps to go. And we've always seen Toba here of late have the really good race pace at the end of the race. And so I sort of got on to a Toba watch, like, where is he? Where is he? When's he coming? I don't want to miss this run through the pack and lead. And with 7 to go, I'm thinking maybe he's just going to lead maybe the last lap and just surprise everyone. Because if you don't know that guy's with you, he has the advantage. It's like warfare. If you don't know where your enemy is, you don't know how to defend against it. And so if you can just come blowing through, make a stellar pass and go to the front, you got a good chance at winning. So I was looking for Toba to show up in the frame. The other one that was surprising to me was Canet didn't seem to be able to do anything with his KTM, which I thought was interesting. He's looked so good the last few races. He's ridden very well, rode within himself, and I just thought maybe Canet was going to just sit there and wait for a nice draft and just show up at the last minute again, sort of. Maybe he was waiting on Toba to come with him or something. I didn't know what was going to happen. But those two I was trying to keep a close eye on around this point of the race. So from there...
Yeah, you figured they were probably saving tires. And then, of course, Toba got the commentator's curse.
That was a vicious little high side. That was out of the first chicane, turn three, I guess that is.
Yeah. And he did the same thing where, oh no, whose bike was it that came back on track just like last week? I think that was the early crash. I think that was Misaki's crash when he went down.
Yeah, the bike continued. That's true.
Yeah, but that was, and then, you know, fortunately when Toba went down, he collected up Sasaki. Not a great day for the Japanese and the Moto 3 paddock. But you know, I was kind of looking at the end results here, right? And I was kind of looking at my notes too. It's like, who didn't take a turn at the front of this race, it seems like? It's like, okay, go through this guy at the front. I have my notes, like Antonelli, he made a crime. Antonelli, where the hell did he qualify at? I don't even know if he was even in the top. Where was Antonelli at? Oh, he was sixth. I think he slipped back.
Antonelli fell all the way down to 21st position during that race. And then, boom, he was at that guy. He was at the front. It was like, replace Toba, scratch that out of your scorecard, people, and write in Antonelli as the audible play, and suddenly, whoa, he's at the front and taking a turn for it. So you kind of don't know who is going to be last man standing, because the draft is important, that last turn is important, and you're really trying to find out, you know, what kind of dogfight there's going to be between the second turn all the way to the last turn, which is what, 15 there at Mugello. And it was definitely a race between the top guys, and it was a great fight. And
so my question to you is, we've got half a lap left in this race, and then Della Porta makes his move and gets to the front, mind you, with some very precise moves. Are you like me and you were like, oh, dude, he gets the last corner in the lead, he's going to win this thing. Put all my money down right now. Not a chance. He's got it figured out. He gets in that corner, it's over.
I would have pushed all my chips to the center of the table too, because I thought at that point, Della Porta had taken the lead down through Casanova there. And again, brilliant move, clean, didn't set anybody up. And I'm thinking, wow, with the way he gets off that last turn, who is going to be able to go with him? Because he's carrying so much more corner speed and a few more RPM that he's going to be able to hold off everyone else that's going to come charging at him. Or he has a really good chance at it, even though it's Moto 3. So I'm at that point, I was like, this is Della Porta's. There's no way around that. But as we found out, going through that last turn, even the commentators had pretty much resigned to the fact that Della Porta had this race. But Arbolino was not to be denied. I don't know exactly how he did it. I've watched this pack several times. I'm thinking that...
Got it right once. It was the only time it mattered.
So basically, Della Porta got off the turn, what I thought was enough drive to actually get there. And
it was he had a gap.
Arbolino was definitely charging and sniffing for the still air off the back of Della Porta's bike. As it finished, Arbolino wins. By the smallest of margins, he wins by 29 thousandths of a second. That's like the width of a front tire. That's maybe at that. And he beats Della Porta to the line. The only way I think Della Porta lost that race is Della Porta yanked that bike over so hard to try to snap that draft that I'm
yes, that's what I thought too.
Because when he snapped it over to the left, to what would be Della Porta's left, as you're looking at it, our right on the race, I thought, oh my God, he's going to overrev the bike because you're changing the diameter of the tire, and it's going to a smaller diameter, and I'm like, oh, it's going to be on the rev limiter, and it's going to preserve it. The bike's going to cut out. It's going to fuel cut to keep the rev back. And I think that momentary has, I don't know if the bike really did that or not, because I didn't see it on board. And even if it's on board, I don't know if you'd actually hear the electronics interfering with that part of it. But I got to believe he floated that RPM up there, and it was just enough just to keep him from winning the race. I think if he would have just either made more of a slight bow and kept the bike on the center of the tire, or didn't try to break the toe, I think Della Porta would have won it. But it was still incredible to see those guys come across the line that close. It was just a fascinating race all the way around. So, as we said, Arbolino won the race, which that was that Arbolino's first win in Moto 3? I think it was his first win.
I didn't pay attention. Usually they throw out the stats at the end. I feel like he might have had a win.
But didn't he have the win? Didn't he have the win at Le Mans, but they took it away because of the track limits or something there at the end, like last year? I think that's what happened, but
yeah, that's why I was saying fuzzy, because I feel like I remember when he was on the team, whatever, when he was wearing the white and the black, and then I feel like something like he had a win or something was mysterious about his win. Well, regardless.
So Arbolino wins it. Della Porta goes second. Masia comes by for third. Antonelli was fourth.
Which he came out of nowhere. Great result for him, because he only showed up. He made his appearance way, way late. He showed about 5 laps to go. He pushed towards the front, and that was about the only time we've seen up there the whole race.
And then Foggia was sort of like from nowhere. Like, where did Foggia come from? Well, he finished fifth and a good ride. McPhee had a good ride in sixth as well. Canet, the championship leader, in seventh. Suzuki winds up eighth, and Vietti there was ninth. And then Darren Binder was 10th. So that's how it figures out. So you had two Hondas and a KTM on the podium. Basically, Masia probably just getting there basically as a result of all the draft from the two bikes off front, pulling him to that third position over Antonelli. But it was a mix of like Honda KTM, Honda KTM, Honda KTM there as you work through the rest of the top 10. But
so here's how crazy close this racing is. I just kind of saw this right now. First place, top kilometers per hour, 159.3. Second, 159.3. Third, 159.3. Fourth, 159.3. Fifth, 159. 159.3 all the way back to eighth, and then it goes 159.2, ninth and tenth, and then 159.1, 11, 12, 13. And then there's a big, big drop to a 157.8, which actually is kind of a big drop in a slipstream. But, man, that is tight. The top 10 all within a second and a half. And at that track is pretty damn close. You really didn't have a drop back. I think the big second group was led by a Cornfile back there in 14th. They were plus 22 seconds. But the top 13 were all with under 3 seconds within each other. I mean, that's 15 bikes just went by. Cool.
So it was good. It was a very good race for Moto3. You had a lot of the passing that you want to see, the drafting. You had the strategy call at the very end, and Della Porta just came up short. So it was a great race. Great race.
Sometimes you get motored. I mean, that's all there is to it. Man, it is what it is. That's one of the hardest ones to take, man. When you get beat like that. I don't know about you, Jim. When I lose, I'd rather get blown out than lose by a little bit, because I nitpick.
I don't know. I don't think I was that way. I mean, if I got beat by a little bit, I was always one of those like, okay, what was those little things that I needed to improve? Because obviously we're close. It isn't like we got beat by, you know, 5 seconds, and now we got to figure out how to find a huge amount of time.
So this is how the other brain thinks. See, when I lose by a little bit, it was, where did I mess up? Not where can I get better. It was, where did I screw up this loss? All right. So Jim takes it as a learning lesson, and I take it as a defeat. Well, there you go. There's two sides of the brain.
Moto 2?
Moto 2. Qualifying. Another, well, at this track.
Oh, wait a minute. We didn't do the championship. Hold on. We didn't do the championship for Moto 3.
Oh, back it up. What's it?
So the championship, as it rolls out, Canet now is still our championship leader. He's on 83 points, but De La Porta, with that second place finish, pulls to within 3 points. He's on 80. Antonelli is on 70 points in third. Mossi is fourth. Vietti fifth. Arbolino is sixth. Toba is seventh. McPhee's in eighth. Mino ninth. And Rodrigo 10th. It looks like it's going to be a battle of consistency between Aaron Canet and De La Porta and who rides with the head their best and rides smart and decides to take.
Yeah, because, and this is like you were saying, that this is ever more prevalent with, you got to be consistent, because think about the name that's missing from that top 10, but who's been up front in every single race this year. We've talked about him a bunch lately. We could have talked to him about this race. He was in the front a lot. Where's Suzuki? Not in the top 10. That's why you gotta finish the race.
You gotta keep it on two wheels, people. Because there's a life lesson for you, little boys and girls. You're starting to gotta keep it on two wheels.
They could just call us, Jim. I mean, seriously, we got this podcast going. Suzuki, you know what? We got a hotline. Man, you just give me a call. I'll let you know. Just more gas, less brake, stay on two wheels. You're gonna get some W's, maybe a championship.
You're welcome. With Suzuki, though, I'd rather have a guy who's fast and teach him how to be consistent than try to have a guy who's consistent but not fast. You can fix that, right?
All right. Well, then you can work with Sam Lowe's. Oh, another dig at Lowe's. Gotta stop.
I mean, because if you think, if you're Suzuki, you got to look at it from this standpoint.
Oh, we're at the half-hour mark. There goes that beer.
So, I mean, if you're Suzuki, you got to look at it and say, look, I have the speed. There's obviously some small part missing. So there's something about either how you have the bike set up that you're using too much tire where you don't have it at the end when you need it, or you're riding not with your brain. You need to kind of sit back in the pack and run in that 2-3-4 kind of spot, which happens in most of the Moto 3 races, and then turn it on at the very end. This is where I think, especially Moto 3 guys, they need a mentor. They need a riding coach. It, kind of similar to, like, I think a lot of the pro golfers have it. I think Tiger Woods has a coach that coaches him. I think, it doesn't matter. Anyway, there are other guys in the pits that have sort of a mentor, kind of. Dovizioso's kind of mentored sort of Pirro a little bit this year, and we'll probably get to that later. But Petrucci, thank you. Sorry, Dan Lowe. And I think this is where these Moto 3 guys could really help, by having a Moto GP guy take him under the wing. This is the part where I see Rossi being of great value to his team, because he can kind of help them understand, because he's been on the bike, he's been racing long enough, he knows what it takes and what it feels. And if you have a rider talking to another rider, you talk on a different level. I mean, if you've ever been around, like, doctors, if the two of them are talking, they talk in a different language that you as the layperson don't really understand. But that's kind of the way riders are. You talk on a level that different people standing outside don't understand, but there's that communication that Rossi can give them to explain the situation and then make them that better rider. And he can kind of sort of be that in-between buffer that says, hey, he needs to have the bike feel more like this, so maybe we need to look at where we're running preload on the front forks, or the rebound we're using, or whatever that it may be. But I think there's of huge value to these guys to have a mentor.
Absolutely. I mean, not only that, but they're going to be able to give them the most recent experience, right?
Sure.
You can bring in a guy who hasn't raced in 30 years, and yeah, his knowledge is great, but it may be dated, versus someone who just wrapped this up. You know, they did their Moto 3 career. Can we imagine Marquez giving you Moto 3 information or Moto 2 information? Sure. It's like, yeah, he's a MotoGP champion four times over, but then again, he was just in Moto 2 like six years ago. It's like, he's gonna know, like, he's gonna give you some great tips on how the tracks are now, because tracks have changed. Even some corners have changed. The mentality of how you hold yourself in that paddock has changed. No, there's no more sipping a Coors and having a cigarette outside the back at the end of the race. Now, to end the race, you eat your salad, go home, and train for 6 hours to get back in shape. I mean, that's what these guys do now. It's much different. So, yeah, it's totally important to have those kind of people there is to keep your mind right. I mean, we've seen this recently, even in the top level with MotoGP. Johann Zarco, you know, he definitely has had a tough year this year. Everybody but him knew this was going to be a tough year, apparently. So they brought in the motocrosser.
Jean-Michel Bale. What's
his name?
You're welcome.
Thank you. I am glad that you kept up with the names because I was going to feel horrible if I couldn't bring up the name of the person that I was trying to bring a memory about. Anyway, brought him in to coach, a.k.a. get his shit together this year.
That beer has so taken effect.
Get down the track and stop pouting out the back. You know, they bring in somebody who's not only, of course, of the same countrymen, so the language barrier, the cultural barrier, all that's out, but someone who's been through adversity. I mean, this is a guy who came from Europe over to America, and of course, did the deal like, what's this go? What's Frenchie going to do on a bike except kick our ass? Oh, whoops, we weren't expecting that. Okay, cool. But yeah, so it does do wonders, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of guys that, you know, we forget about that go out there and coach, and that's kind of like your, I wouldn't say a fallback plan, but your next step in your career is you're done racing. All right, go coach the next level up. And we had mentioned, you know, last time when Rossi gets done racing, he's not going to be out of that paddock for years because that's going to be his next thing, step down. He's already set that up for himself. And then I think you're going to see guys, I think Marquez is starting to do that now, and you're going to see, maybe that's part of the reason why there's not as many Americans, because there's only really one guy, I think, out of all the American racers that's really doing that right now, and that's Colin Edwards.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And I think Kevin Schwantz was doing that for a bit, helping selected riders he would kind of work with here and there. He never really had the backing of a huge program, but really their Texas Tornado boot camps kind of turned into a much bigger thing, and he kind of gets people down there, but that's still not a dedicated source for pumping these guys up, because none of these guys are in the paddock anymore. There's no one to help you learn how to make that transition from America to the European circuit. It's a difficult transition. It's different people. It's different cultures. It's different way you hold yourself. I mean, you can't be your loud American self in a European paddock. That doesn't go down too well over there. I mean, it's much different. There's emotions over there. Not so much here. But it's different. And that's where it starts. If you got to get that part down, and then you've got to learn the tracks. And I mean, you can ask any of these guys. I mean, I've talked to Cam Beaubier about this when he was over there, and he was this 12-year-old who had a little bit of pudge on him, and he was Mark Marquez's teammate. And it's like, well, Marquez is from the area, runs it up, and, you know, Cam is right there and gets lost in his shadow and misses home. And it's tough. You know, it's hard to take these kids, literally 11, 12 years old, plant them over and be like, all right, good luck. Here's a new culture of fame, everything. All right, cool. I'm 12 years old. You throw me in the same situation. It's not happening.
Man, it's tough.
All right. Time is getting away. Let's blast through Moto2 qualifying really fast because the race was...
We can go just as fast as the race as well. GP race. Take us through qualifying, for real. Skyler.
All right, so qualifying. Once again, I did not watch.
There you go.
But Vierge made his way through the front. Baldessari made his way through. I'm sorry, not to the front, but through qualifying to Baldessari, Bellega, and
Baldessari.
Who was the other one there from?
Baldessari, Bellega, Martin, and Martin. All or Vierge. Sorry,
that's right.
All made it through Q1 to Q2.
That's right, and that gets us up to our pole man, Marcel Schwarzer, which we've seen this a whole lot, and he had, I think it was a crash in one of the practices where he kind of banged himself up a bit. So good over one lap. We were going to see if he could hold it down through the rest of the race. His teammate, Tom Luthi, there qualified second. So Dynavolt, Intact GP definitely has their stuff together. Alex Marquez sitting third. Bellega probably had his best qualifying, I think, of the season there in fourth, followed by Jorge Navarro, who's also having a strong season. And back by Marini, Nagashima, Lowe's, Fernandez, Gardner out your top 10. There are 9 KLXs and 1 speed up. The main theme that was going on this entire weekend was where the hell is KTM? Top qualifier by Jorge Martin was in 12th, and Brad Binder was nowhere to be seen. Iker Lecuona, nowhere to be seen. It was not a good weekend for KTM, to the point where they had to bring it up that they are going to have to make some changes in their program. And when people say that, that means someone's ass got put out.
Yeah, somewhere, some way, KTM missed something major on this, and don't know what it is, but heads will roll, you know. So yeah, that's just not acceptable from a team with that resource, that money, and the talent that's on those bikes. I mean, come on, Jorge Martin is a Moto 3 world champion, and you got Binder has looked fantastic on that bike racing next to Oliveira, and they're nowhere to be found.
Binder's a Moto 3 champ too, isn't he? Oh no, we're embarrassing ourselves again. We should know this.
Again, we don't remember anything past 7 months, okay?
It's cool. I can go back and edit it, and nobody will even know better.
Dude, Brad Binder was the 2016 Moto 3 champion. Come on, how do you not remember? You are so bad at this. Sincerely, Harry Lloyd's robot friend.
Let's get to the race.
Oh man, this was... This, you know, when we went to this change of the new Triumph bikes and the new frames, everyone was like, oh man, like this is going to be back to like the first year when Moto2 came back in and everything was different. We had 15 people running up front. You never, nope, not it. It wasn't a big enough change apparently because KLX is still dominating and this is the first race you've seen one rider dominate, and that was Alex Marquez. What was it? Maybe lap 7? He passed Schrader?
Nah, I think it was even earlier than that, to be honest with you.
It might have been earlier. And then then everybody else started fighting once another, and Alex kind of got away and had a... I mean, he's looking good. Alex is... He looks smart. He doesn't look out of control. And he knows how to get the gap and then hold it there.
Yeah, he's learning from his brother. Who's a better mentor than your brother? You know, five-time MotoGP champion and a two-time Moto2 champion. But this is one of the things that I thought would happen. I thought with the Triumph and having more of a torquey type of motor versus the inline 4 or 600s, that the guys who race dirt track would have a better chance on that bike. And Marquez is starting to show that he is gelling with that bike. Now, anything can happen. I'm not going to predict Marquez as the champion of this season, but of all the races so far, his Le Mans win on a tricky track that day and his dominant win here at Mugello on a fast track where there should have been a draft that should have put a bunch of other people in contention, he rode off and made everybody look pretty damn stupid. That's a good thing. Marquez has needed this kind of effort, and he needs to keep this effort going with another podium at Barcelona in Spain. And if he can do that, then I think he's going to be a threat for the championship. But on the Baddock side of that, I think for somehow, some way, Baldessari has got to figure out how to up his game, because he's won 3 races, but can't seem to figure anything out now. Like, something went wrong. And
I still wonder if he had some lingering effects from the last crash.
Okay.
He did make a good comeback throughout the race to finish 4th. Mm-hmm. Didn't have the greatest of starting positions. I mean, he qualified back in 15th. I mean, that's a pretty decent climb mm-hmm. through the field.
Well, they definitely...
especially at this track, but...
The Pons team definitely celebrated Baldessari's 4th like it was a victory. That's for sure. I mean, and he did. He rode up through the pack to have a good finish. And again, it's consistency. You've got to have that happening all the time. And maybe they are going to get there. But for a race, though, at Mugello, this was pretty much a snoozer, to be honest.
It really was.
I hate
to
say that.
I was hoping... Yeah, I mean, it looked like it was going to be a little bit of a battle at first, and Schrader went backwards. Luthi didn't put up much of a fight. And then you kind of had this train of Marini, Luthi, And I want to say, I don't know if Baldessari was up there at the time, but they were just kind of sitting in place. I think it was when Schrader was up there. So it was Schrader, Marini, and Luthi. They all looked like they were getting ready to throw down. And then basically once they get past Schrader, they kind of just singled out. And then Marini caught up to Luthi and made a mistake and then had to repass. And then Baldessari kind of caught back up. Augusto Fernandez had a nice finish. But it really was, I mean, Navarro, he probably had the most exciting race. He was doing two steps forward, one step back through most of the race, get there and blow a corner, but also was running extremely quick laps on his bike that was down on speed a little bit. But he was definitely having a good race. Sam Lowes came out in the beginning and said, all right, I got to stay on the bike this race. He did exactly that and had what I would call a safe race tonight. That's good points. That's the top 10. That's getting your head back on straight after having a couple tough weekends. So, that, you know, good, solid top 10. And it, like you said, it was kind of a par for the course. This was if you needed to go grab some food, this was the time to do it. It wasn't much of a race, especially after what we had in Moto 3 and what was backed up by the end with MotoGP. It was kind of like, okay, cool. It was fine. It was a race. Nothing much happened. So
we touched on this, but look, the first KTM home, Brad Binder, 15th for 1 point.
And that was after hard work too.
Hell of a lot of hard work to get to that point. But yeah.
Yeah. Cause he was not there for most of the race and it's not looking good, especially when Speed Up, who's probably a quarter of the budget of KTM, is showing them up and showing them up good. I mean, Navarro, he finished in seventh, but he was running top five at one point. And Fabio DJ Antonio, who is a rookie with a top 10 on a Speed Up bike. I mean, he's honing his craft and he's out there putting it to, you know, guys like Brad Binder on this KTM. It's not going to work. They know that. I mean, apparently parts are not coming for Barcelona. They're going to be for, I think, Assen is the race after that. That's when parts are showing up. But there might be some long shifts in the next 2 weeks to get these bikes a little bit up to speed and get them going. But definitely not where they want to be at the moment. Especially because, and I feel bad for, was it Bisecci and Martin? You know, these guys come into Moto2. They're not getting the best of taste or getting a very good showcase in their first year.
No, not at all, but they've got the talent, and once KTM gets the engineering side of it figured out, they'll be fine. But I do wonder if the bigger profile Dunlop tire has had an effect to where some people can't ride on it and some people can, or some people just haven't figured out how to ride on that tire. So that,
well, then I mean, if you're thinking that, then, I mean, that's even more kudos to Alex Marquez, right? Mm-hmm. Because he was winning and leading races on the 600s with a much smaller, you know, not
right,
much smaller,
but it's definitely but different
footprint. Yeah, it's definitely different. Now he's, you know, winning and leading right out, mm-hmm. you know, getting back up there right off the bat. I mean, Luthi, you know, he came back down, did it. So you definitely see where the cream is rising towards the top. But these guys, if you can ride multiple things fast, that means you just are a fast rider. And,
yep.
you know, you got to be able to accept the changes. So, you know, maybe what you said is true. Maybe there are certain people that fit that profile before, and now it's just not their thing.
But this is becoming probably the best championship right now, because if we look at the standings, Baldessari still leads. Mm-hmm. He's on 88 points.
Somehow.
Yes. He's still hanging on. Marquez,
just enough.
Marquez with the two wins in a row to get 50 points, bolts him into second, only 2 points behind on 86. Luthi's right there on 84 points, and Navarro is there on 73 points. So your top four there, any one of those guys can put a couple of races together and win, could easily step up in the championship and win it. So I'm really excited more, not so much about the racing, but about the championship in this class. And with the way I look for Navarro to have a bounce back race in Barcelona, that's a place where that edge grip of the Speed Up will definitely help. And remember, Quartararo won there last year on a Speed Up. So I'm hoping Navarro can pull something off there. But again, this is a good championship. It's nice, close. It's pretty tight after five or six races in now. So it's good. It's good. So let's go to MotoGP. Unless you've got anything else you want talk about.
No, oh, hell no.
Let's talk about the good stuff. All right. Race,
We are already creeping up on an hour, and I don't even know how long we're going to talk about it, because
hey, they're in it for the long haul. Yeah. They're still here. So, The first MotoGP qualifying session. Think of the big names that are in this session. Dovizioso, yep. Rossi, Rins, and Dovi, Lorenzo, Rossi, and Rins. The four big names that are in this first qualifying session. Shocking. You wouldn't have expected that. Michele Pirro was very quick with Rins. They had quick laps, and you're just wondering if they were going to hold out. And then at the very end, with basically no time left on the clock, Dovi jumps up and takes that P1 spot for Q1, and he goes on to the second qualifying session with the other Ducati, that of Michele Pirro. Rins can't get it done with the Suzuki because there's a top speed deficit that bike has. So Suzuki definitely needs to go back to the drawing board and try to eke out a little.
And Rins is not a Saturday guy.
No, he's now becoming. No, he's definitely. He is like becoming the new Rossi because he's pulling off some Sunday magic. But we'll get to that, I promise. Mm-hmm. One last thing for first qualifying session, Zarco's crash. We talked a little bit about Zarco before. Zarco had a very big crash. It was very awkward. If you watch that crash, he loses the front and he simply just gave up. In my opinion, looking at him and his body language, the front end kind of folded and then he just let go of it and the bike sort of righted itself. And he's lucky he didn't get drugged with the motorcycle along there, because that was a very high speed section of track, because that was that's the S curves that was the entry to the big curve after Casanova, right? You come down the hill and then you're running to the two current corners that are the first one and the second one. I can't think of what it is at the far end of the circuit, but I think it was going into there. So that was a very big crash, very awkward. And like I said, it was very weird. It was like the front folded a little bit and he just got scared of it, or he lost the feel and said, oh, I'm bailing, and just let go of it. The bike really wasn't down. And I guess, you know, you have that bit of Marquez magic that you think of, like, oh, that's a savable crash because you expect somebody to save it. And if Marquez had been in that situation, you know he would have put it back on two wheels. Or Zarco just gave up, which again goes to the fact that, you know, why he's got Jean-Michel Bayle there with him to kind of keep his mind straight, because it has been anything but a decent time for him on that motorcycle. So, but we get the two Ducatis out of it. Out of the first session.
Yeah, we get the two Ducatis out, and it brings us over to Q2. Mark Marquez, shocker, gets pole. Actually, kind of was a shocker. I was going to say the shocker made for Quartararo out there again, putting it almost on pole. He lost out by 0.2 seconds to Marquez. Top Yamaha again, and then he was back that performance up, and Petrucci had a nice strong in third, but getting his first row there. But Franco Morbidelli with the Petronas, they both of the factory bikes that may be a little long in the tooth compared to development of this year's bikes, out qualifying the factory bikes considerably.
Yes. Not good.
I don't know what's going on at Yamaha.
Not either.
They got some problems. But the thing is, it's almost a shame because you're like, oh, he gets second and Morbidelli fourth. It doesn't matter. That bike is dog shit off the line. So they're just going to get sucked up anyway. Vinales has been giving us his proven theory all along. And then, man, we'll get to that in a second at the start of the race. But Jack Miller in fifth, Crutchlow sixth. Crutchlow has been having quietly, I think, a good season considering how mangled his leg was at the beginning of the season. I think he's having some strong rides here, keeping himself. And then, with Vinales there in seventh. Bagnaia, who probably had his best weekend until he fell off, qualified in eighth. Vizioso there, ninth, which when we get to the start of the race, we're going to get on that. And you know what? There's no point in talking about the rest of qualifying. Let's just get to the race. Dying. I mean, it's sure.
I'll give you three quick gym points off of Q2. One, Marquez used his brain, changed his strategy, and changed it so that he could draft the Ducati to go to pole. Fascinating. Quartararo proving that he's definitely somebody to be reckoned with if you can figure out how to get the motorcycle off the line, because he's definitely fast. There's no doubt about that. And the fact that Rossi is, and the fact that, and the third point, the fact that the two satellite Yamahas are out qualifying the factory team means that there needs to be a house cleaning like KTM is going to go through at Yamaha, because something just isn't right there. So on to the race. Let's move forward.
No, it, you know, to go on with your point, though, like, yeah, it is the money, the effort, everything. I don't know who's safe at Yamaha now. I mean, it's weird. I thought for sure we'd be seeing something different this year, or at least some improvements, and we're just not seeing it, man. I don't know what's going on there. I think there's a fundamental issue with the development of that bike. We've seen it over the last couple of years. They've struggled ever since they went to the new tire in 2017. I mean, that's been it. I mean, Vinales was winning races, and then there was nothing. And Rossi had a few standing moments from there, but I think that was more him than bike, of course. It's just, I don't know. We've beat this horse, but it's just shocking. It doesn't make any sense considering how good they've been this last decade to be where they are now and what they're doing. I don't know, man. It's
weird. This is Rossi's, not to spoil anything, but this is Rossi's worst dry race since like 2007. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's gotten to the point now where it's absolutely utterly ridiculous. That's where we are now. It isn't, and regardless, it doesn't seem like anybody can even remotely get it right. For some reason, I just don't understand. You think they would get it by now. You think that they could, but they're not. So let's get into the race. Let's actually get into the race. Enough of qualifying on us. So
we get to the start, and like we had said, the Yamahas were terrible off the line. Quartararo goes backwards. He almost collects his teammate. And we almost run
and then
he's
never heard from again.
Dovizioso. Right, yeah. Pretty much. Dovizioso just, I don't know what this hole shot device and how it works. I mean, I'm sure it's, you know, locking suspension down just like on.
Yeah, that's cross, exactly what it's doing. Yeah,
it's working because Dovizioso just shot through the field to be right up there in the top three. Like, mm-hmm. Boom! Right now, Marquez up there, Petrucci up there, and lately we've been having these races where people get up there and let's manage the tires.
That's all Dovizioso loves to do is manage the race. Manage to get up front and. In dirt track parlance, he wants to pole putt, make everybody go the long way round, and he's going to win the race at the slowest pace possible.
And he could do that with the Ducati because he can drag him down the straight and pass him on the brakes. That's just how he's figured out how to work it. But this race, it made it great because that means everybody was in the fight and they were passing each other. There were more passes in this race for the lead than I think there have been the whole year, all races combined.
This was the best race of the year so far. I mean, this was fantastic racing. Yeah. I mean, as you said, Quartararo falls off. Rins also comes to the front. I mean, Rins is just, he's the Sunday man.
Well, he didn't fall off. He fell back.
Quattro, like, whoa, yeah, okay. Make sure we get there. He fell down the order. How's that? Yeah, Rins rode a fantastic race because all of a sudden, boom, Rins was right at the front after maybe two laps.
Yeah, another great
start. Did really get, I mean, Rins was great on passer. Fire. Rins was riding the wheels off that motorcycle.
He's making a fan.
Oh, me too. Derek, you were so right that they definitely should have kept Rins at Suzuki. I'll give you that. And I'm now convinced, I'm a fanboy. I'm on the wagon with that. Rins rode impeccable. He was just using the bike. He was using it, all the corner speed that he could get out of it. He was definitely late on the brakes with everyone and holding right there. So the whole front was just crazy. And it looked like a Moto 3 race. It literally looked like a Moto 3 race because there was, seven guys that were out front in that lead group, and they were just amazing.
Yeah, and the best part is when Marquez was leading, and you're like, okay. And then he got beat up all the way back to fourth, and I was like, holy shit, he's got to pass people now. Like, this is going to be a race. And, oh, man. And then we had, Petrucci and Miller were duking it out there for a little bit. It just really, us talking about it, does this race no justice. If you haven't watched it, what's wrong with you? Why are you listening to this right now? This was the best race that's been, I don't know, the last 10. Yeah. That's great.
I thought for sure when Marquez got dusted up there at the beginning, I thought, oh, holy crap, here comes the red mist. This guy's just going to go bonker crazy, and he's going to throw this thing onto the ground trying to be faster than anybody. And he kind of
Dude, he got outbullied. He tried to bully Miller.
Couldn't do it.
That shit wasn't gonna happen. Miller gave it right back to him.
That was awesome to see. That was so awesome.
Right back to him. DaVincio.
Because it was like,
man, these guys.
It was the idea that, look, Miller's not gonna take that shit from Marquez. I'm totally fine with that.
Nope, from nobody.
I don't mind a bit of a rough up as long as it's clean, right? There's a point where you can cross a line and be dirty, right? But nothing that these guys did here at all was dirty. It was just nice,
elbows
tight,
out.
Elbow out, aggressive racing. And it was absolutely fantastic. Rossi actually crashed out of the race. Think about
that. Yeah, because he crashed out of last place too at the time, because he got set back there because he ran into the back of Mir going into the chicane. Yep. And we had to run through the dirt, and then where do you lose it? At the top of nine?
I think he crashed out at nine. Yeah, that's. I mean, I'm trying to think. When's the last time you saw Rossi crash out of a MotoGP race?
I'll tell you, it was his first DNF since Japan 2017. Oh, with the stats,
you're doing good there, man. But it was.
I got my one hairy moment.
There you go. We'll have to write that down so that we can celebrate it later on. We'll have to put you on the podium at the end of the year. But
thank you.
But the thing was that it was funny because Dovi was trying to slow that race down so much, and you know, because the Ducatis all went on the medium combination of tires. Marquez had hard, and I think. Even Crutchlow went on a medium rear, but Crutchlow had the hard front. Basically, everybody was medium, just because of the heat. They didn't think the soft was going to make the distance. And it was down to it at the end, after, you know, this knockdown drag out, basically barroom fight between Petrucci, Dovizioso, Rins, and Marquez was literally like a barroom fight. They did not give an inch anywhere. And the funny thing was that Petrucci would keep going past Dovizioso because Dovizioso's pace was not fast enough for him. And I'm going, this makes no sense to me, because Petrucci's the biggest guy in the paddock. He just weighs the most. He's going to use the tire even more, and he wants to run at a pace that's even faster than what Dovizioso, who's known for being sort of easy on the tires, is willing to go at. Now, Dovizioso is not that far behind Marquez in the championship. I was trying to think, is Dovizioso purposefully trying to slow all this down to put enough bikes between him and Marquez to get back to the top of the championship? Because I think we would agree. I think we would agree. Dovizioso is probably the most thoughtful and methodical, well thought, thinking rider on the grid, right? He's very engineering. It's all very strategic. It's all very thought out. It's like, well, hey, look, I'm at a track. And I think he did. He looked at it this way. Look, I'm at Mugello. I'm at a track that my bike works extremely well at. I've got the horsepower. I got top speed advantage. I got my teammate who's doing really well right with me. Oh, and by the way, I got this guy named Miller, and there for a long time you had who's the other one on the other Pramac? Bagnaia. Thank you. Bagnaia, Baliga, and all those are all running together. I couldn't get who it was, but Ben, he had Bagnaia. So there was every possibility that if he could have slowed that down enough, you know Miller was going to take a run at Marquez. So Marquez conceivably not been third. Marquez could have been fourth, maybe fifth, but, you know, Bagnaia crashed out of a position that he could have had.
Oh, yeah, he was having such a good race. I think he was up to seventh at the time, got a little wide there in the last corner and too much lean angle on the dirty track, and down he went.
Again, Dovizioso was riding so slow, Quartararo was actually sort of catching up.
Yeah, they were all catching back up. Crutchlow was coming back up. Nakagami was coming back up. Quartararo was coming back up. Hell, even Vinales was slowly getting reeled back in towards that group. So it was coming from like a 4 or 5 all the way to like an 8 to 9 rider battle at that point.
And it was also interesting because every time Petrucci got out front, Dovizioso would run hard enough to get back in front of him and slow it all back down again. And eventually, you sort of got to where Rins kind of kind of fell off of the pace. He couldn't really...
Yeah, it was about the halfway point, right? They turned it up about the halfway point.
The boys in red finally turned it up, and Rins couldn't stay with them. The deficit in top speed in the Suzuki is too much. He cannot stay with them, despite the best that he was doing. He was starting to lose edge grip on those tires. No fault of Rins. He probably rode the best race of anybody at the front to finish where he did. But you had the three protagonists that you kind of expected were going to come out of this fighting for the lead for the last three or four laps. You had Petrucci, you had Dovizioso, and you had Marquez. And you're trying to figure out in what order are these three guys going to wind up on the podium. And you finally got down to the last lap, and man, Dovizioso was leading. Petrucci comes after him, and then Marquez just goes whizzing by like he had an afterburner because he had that double draft. And when Marquez went flying by them, I'm like, oh, baby, you're too deep. You are too late with the brakes. This is not going to be good. And Marquez ran it that little bit wide, which let Dovizioso drive back in on him. So Dovizioso was able to stay out a little bit wider, turn back in earlier than what Marquez could, because Marquez is still trying to catch the bike, if you will. And just when you thought, oh, those two are going to go trade leather, who comes up the inside in the smallest of gaps but Petrucci, who sits up Dovizioso, who then sits up Marquez. And then as you go into the chicane, it's like, well, Marquez kind of rebounds because, let's be honest, that Honda now accelerates and damn near has as much top speed as a Ducati. Plus, it handles better. So Marquez was going to go up the inside, and Dovizioso was stuck in the middle. His hand closed on the throttle, which let Petrucci and Marquez go in the corner side by side. Well, that gave Mark the inside advantage, but the chicane goes back the other way, which means you had Petrucci going to come out of that situation in front, and he did. And to be honest with you, I think Petrucci rode the lap of his life for that. And Marquez, you knew he was going to take a run at him. You're just trying to figure out exactly where he was going to do it, and he tried. And each time he tried, Marquez tried to pass Petrucci, that is. Petrucci closed the door, was riding exactly where he needed to go to keep Marquez at bay. And you're thinking, well, it's going to come down to that last second draft. And as they rambled off that last turn, you thought Marquez, who does really good in that corner, he's kind of like the Della Porta of MotoGP with that turn. But it wasn't enough. The Ducati had enough power to hold off Marquez to where Petrucci wins it, but he won it by 43 thousandths of a second. So basically, it was twice the distance of what the Moto 3 finish was in rough terms. And then Dovizioso was another 0.3 farther back, because I think after that dust up in the first chicane, Dovizioso was like, I'm just gonna ride in third and kind of watch this, because I think he was thinking, Marquez is probably going to go after Petrucci, and there's every chance that both he and Petrucci are going to fall off, just because Marquez was going to shove it somewhere where he didn't need to be, and you knew it could potentially happen, but it never did. And that was sort of what you were looking for. But it was a great ride and a great win for Petrucci. His first ever win. He won it in his home, in front of his home team, an Italian racetrack on an Italian motorcycle. That's just something he's just going to remember for the rest of his life.
What a way to get your first win. I mean, let's check the boxes, shall we?
Okay. Sure, go ahead.
On Ducati. First of all, you're Italian.
Check.
On Ducati. Check. Home race. Check. Mugello in front of your teammate. Check. There's been talks. Who's going to get the contract? You or Miller. Miller crashes out. You win the race. Check. I mean, what else is there to do at that point? That was, you put all the cards on the table and you had a royal flush, man. I mean,
that was nice.
What a weekend. And, people like myself have to eat a little bit of crow. I didn't think Petrucci had it in him to do what he did. He didn't win that race because it was wet. He didn't win that race because other people crashed. He won that race because he put a ballsy pass on those guys into turn one. He wanted that race. He put it out front and he rode his ass off to get that win. It was, dude, one of the best wins I've seen. I mean, that was earned 100%.
Very much so.
To him. Didn't care. It was locked in with tunnel vision to catch that one out. And that made three wins in a row for Ducati. That was something else. That's another checkbox. Keep the streak alive. I mean, man, this guy is just... I'm pretty sure with that, though, that might put to bed some of those things, because I think the whole contract thing was supposed to be settled by Barcelona, which is the next race. And unless something crazy happens, man, I think Miller might just want to go ahead and put the ink on the Pramac, deal and lock that position down, or maybe find something else, because... You win for Italy at
Gel, you will be rewarded.
Like, yeah, that is a huge deal. I mean, it's just like Ferrari. If you win at Monza, you're going to get a contract. That's all there is to it.
So, that's true. It's true.
I mean, this was the race we've been waiting for this year.
It was fantastic.
Yeah, leading up to this race, it's just been like, okay, it's been, if Marquez doesn't screw up, he's going to win, and then we'll kind of go from there, and Yamaha's not going to compete, and who's going to be the stop? There we go. Like, now it's like a brand new season. It's like, woo, all right. Breathe some excitement back into it, and we had a hell of a race. Ended up getting, Petrucci getting the win, Marquez in third, Dovizioso, of course, in third. Alex Rins, like you said, if it wasn't for Petrucci winning, I would say Alex Rins has the best ride of the day. He still might. He definitely had a fantastic race, just losing out there on the top end. Taka Nakagami had a hell of a race. That was the top five. I think that's his highest place finish ever in MotoGP, if I'm not mistaken.
He got to go to the Parc Fermé because he was a top independent team.
Yep.
It's a shame that we didn't get to see him on TV more, because obviously it was a great ride for him. But
he's kind of a no man's land, right?
Yeah, but that front battle was so good that he really did. He was sort of the forgotten racer of it all. Vinales was sixth, followed by Pirro
salvaging a sixth place, mind you. Yes. Vinales had to do a lot of work to get that sixth place on that bike. Well, the bike just didn't look good either. Like, if you watch him, that bike did not look very Vinales-y. It was kind of moving around a bit. That's weird for a Yamaha, especially for Vinales, smooth rider.
But you know what? I'm beginning to wonder, and I don't know this for certain. Look at the bikes that are at the front that are fast. The Honda, that thing moves around underneath Marquez all the time.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the Ducatis, they tend to move around a little bit, but they don't move around as much as Marquez does on the bike. But the Ducatis do move around.
But they're stable as hell on the brakes, though.
That's the illusion of it, right? They move around a lot on the acceleration at the mid-corner because they're trying to turn, which was what Dovizioso says they have got to fix. And he started to get aggravated by the fact that they have not figured out the mid-turning of the mid-corner turn. And he's aggravated by that. But if you look at Rins's bike is moving around too. Not a little bit more on braking than the Ducatis, but not as much as the Honda. But it still moves around. So maybe the bikes have to be set up in a way to maximize the grip offered by the Michelins, that they have to sort of dance around underneath of you. Even the KTM, if you look at it with pole riding, it definitely moves around a lot too. And maybe that's just how you have to go fast on the Michelin tires. And maybe that's what they can't find the setting at Yamaha, but you'd think Rossi, who's used to 500s, would be able to do it. So I don't know if that theory even holds water. But Crutchlow had an eighth place. Then you had the first KTM. Yeah, good result for Cal. Then Paul Espargaro on the KTM with a ninth at Mugello, backing up the sixth place they had at Le Mans with a ninth place here, which, given that it's Mugello and we know that the KTMs do not have the top speed advantage of what Ducati or Honda have, I think that was a great result for them. Then Quartararo on the Petronas Yamaha, Aleix Espargaro with the Aprilia, Juanmir Lorenzo. Lorenzo down at 13th on a factory Honda. This is now becoming silly. And he still says he can't get the ergonomics right on the bike, which it took him what, a year and a half on a Ducati to figure it out. And I will give you this much with Ducati. Ducati's Italian, and they don't have the resources that Honda has. So it was going to take them a little bit more to do and make that bike work for Lorenzo. There's no what reason Honda shouldn't be able to whip off 3 new gas tanks, 4 new seats, and 3 different fairings and 2 frames with different areas for him to put his knees in. And
this to me goes back to I think what you were talking about when you were concerned that he was coming over to that team was that Honda does not care about his input.
No.
I mean, they've got their man. They're going to build their bike exactly how they want, and he needs to catch up to their development. Which is, he fundamentally, this is not the bike for him. Cal warned him about this. Like, he thought he was going to go over the turn. Cal's like, it's not like that.
Nope.
Cal's got and Lorenzo's riding style is way different than Crutchlow Marquez. Crutchlow Marquez is a very similar riding style. Very aggressive on the front tire.
Yep.
And Lorenzo, it's just not there, man.
Right. And you're very much right about this, because if you look, Lorenzo was on the Yamaha, a bike that's very stable, high corner speeds, great braking stability. What's a Ducati? Great braking stability. Maybe not necessarily as high as cornering speed, because you got to worry about that mid-corner turn where you got to somehow flex it and get it around the bend. But yeah, Lorenzo, all this talk about this being the greatest battle between teammates ever, it's literally like Marquez has definitely just kicked him to the curb, and I don't think Lorenzo is going to... Lorenzo will see out this season, but I do not think Lorenzo will be on that bike next year.
Tough to tell. I will put a bit of an asterisk at this season because he had zero testing.
Yes.
They're having to do all of their testing in season, and that sucks because that's a whole 45 minutes of, a couple of practices and qualifying. It's just not working out, and he's still recovering from injury. It's just been like, all right, dude, if he didn't get hurt on the bike, you know, in the off season, will we be looking at the same thing? So he's got that crutch maybe to lean on, figuratively, literally, right now. Mm-hmm. But... like you say, he's got to just show improvement, and he's kind of gotten lost in this wash where it's, Jerez, we'll really see. Well, dude, we're coming up on Barcelona, and you better show a top 10 at the very least, because if the rumors he was already getting the hurry-up by Honda, we get to the summer break, and he really better get himself right, man.
If he doesn't put up a couple of top 10s before summer break, I think the big talker of summer break is going to be who's going to be on the orange-wheeled bike, because it isn't going to be Lorenzo. Honda wants to win a team's championship, and they're losing it to Ducati year after year. That's not why Honda races. And
you know who wants that Honda seat right now?
Who?
Johann Zarco. Boy, I bet he wish he took that contract because you finished.
DFL,
man. That's not good.
Okay, let's talk about Zarco on a Honda. Do you seriously think that Zarco's style is going to match a Honda, considering he can't make the KTM work?
I don't know, man.
I don't see that as a fit. Now, I was shocked as much as anyone that Zarco signed to go to KTM. But he did start his career in KTM. He knew everybody over there. But I think everybody in the paddock could see that motorcycle was not the motorcycle for Johann Zarco. I think people would have thought, if he really did have a contract, we will never know the answer to this question. But if Zarco did have a contract or an option or a letter of intent signed to ride for Honda, it was probably for more money than what Lorenzo was riding for. So if you had your choice as Honda to take the low bidder for the work that you wanted to have done, and it happened to be a 5-time champion, who would you have picked?
Didn't Zarco sign his contract before Lorenzo did?
He did, but there was always those rumors
played Honda's hand.
Well, it might have. Like I said, I don't know if we're going to know the true story of whether Zarco had a contract or a letter of intent, but if I'm Honda and I'm paying Marquez millions, and you got Zarco, you're going to pay him say 2 million euro. Let's just throw a number out there. I don't know what it is. But then Lorenzo says, hey, I'll ride for 700,000 euro. Well, who are you going to take? I'd take Lorenzo.
I'll take the five-time champion.
Yeah, I would too.
Simple as that.
So,
dude, you know what's crazy now is that not only is he going to the Red Bull, but this is he's got it's bad on both sides because he's on a team that's not doing the great, except for one guy, Pol Espargaró. He's really knocking it out for them right now.
Oh, he's doing
but
great. He's,
obviously, his confidence is taking a big hit. He's getting beat by the junior team at this point. But he can't just be like stroll back up over to what is now, you know, Petronas, go back to Yamaha and be like, guys, just bring me back. You know, I rode that bike good because guys like Morbidelli and Quartararo are there now. And
I wouldn't give up on Quartararo or Morbidelli, no. To be honest. There's no way.
No. They're as good as Zarco was showing. Zarco had some great results on the bike, and these guys are already up there qualifying-wise and, you know, leading races and so on and so forth. So he lost his opportunity there. And, man, things move quick in MotoGP, and I don't want to bag on him like, ha, 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 point my finger, but it's kind of like this is what we were all concerned about.
Yeah.
Like, dude, this was...
And it's coming true.
Yeah, it's like... We want you to turn it around, but I don't think they can. I think they're in a bad spot where the bike isn't what he needs, and now he's starting to pout, and KTM is not happy with him. He's not happy with KTM. That never makes for a good result at the end of the season.
Yeah, you gotta wonder what kind of out clause Zarco has got on that contract, but where is he going to go?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. Like, that's, you know, where are you at now?
You know...
Especially when guys like, you know, Miller could possibly be out there. I mean, he's rode several different bikes. I mean, I throw him on a KTM, see what he can do.
Oh, why not? Couldn't hurt. I still think, and I know this is, I've said it before, and it's probably a stretch, but somehow, some way, somehow I see Alex on the HRC bike with his brother. I have that feeling, and I cannot shake the feeling that that's where he's going to wind up. It may never happen, and I could be completely wrong, but man, I see that coming.
I think you want to see what you want to see, Jim.
There is no spoon. There is no spoon. Okay. Yeah, right. I know. I don't know.
I don't know if that's going to happen. It'd be cool, but I want to see. It'd be cool to see two pairs of brothers in MotoGP at the same time.
Well, see brothers in MotoGP. They're just not on the same team.
No, two sets.
Oh, sorry. Two sets two of brothers. Two sets of brothers. Okay, sorry. I didn't hear that part. Going deaf in my old age.
Yeah.
Man, that was those all. Happens.
I don't speak well after a beer too. So
we're gonna get to championships.
Jim,
let's just roll.
It's almost an hour and a half. Let's get to the end.
Sorry, people, if you're still listening, I appreciate you hanging in there. But Marquez strengthens his championship point standings lead over Dovizioso. So it's now a 12-point lead in there. So that is important to note that. And then you've got Rins there in third, but he's roughly 20 points off of what Dovizioso's got. So it's going to become the Marquez Andrea Dovizioso show. And with Mark,
stop exactly that before.
With you got to think that the upcoming tracks that are here, we're going to go to Catalonia, we're going to go to Assen, we're going to go to Germany, and then we're going to have the break to the Czech, and then to the Czech Republic. You got to say that Marquez has got a great shot at running the table on those three races to the spring break.
Especially Barcelona and Germany. I mean, I think Assen might be able to throw up a curveball, and that's probably Alex Rins.
I think it might be his best chance to win another one would be there, yeah. I agree with you.
But I mean, Germany, you know, Germany's not a bad track for Dovi either. He's done well there, and that power up the hill will help. But man, Marquez is lethal there.
Very much so. So, anyway, let's wrap this thing up, my friend. I think we've done enough damage.
Yeah. No, we get to the end, folks. Thanks for sticking through us. We do have an upcoming race here. We've got a little bit of World Superbike action coming from Jerez. That's this weekend, and we'll be getting on to our World Superbike coverage again, I am sure. We're going to go ahead and be changing the schedule. Like Jen mentioned, I will be taking off for a month over to Europe doing my honeymooning vacation, graduation, present all wrapped up into one. But that will be the start of things changing here on Motopod as well, because when I come back, I'm only here with free time for a couple of weeks and then I start school. as many of you know, or maybe if you don't, this is your first episode where you've been, but I'm going to be going to university or college for those of us here in the States this year, the big boy school, and I'm going to be going year round from here on out for the next probably 3 years. So I am probably winding down my participation in Motopod for the most part as a regular host. I may pop it from time to time, but most likely I'm not going to have the time to be on the show or really watch that much racing just because I am piling myself with the workload so I can get this done after 15 years of trying. So you'll be getting used to the hosts as they are. We'll be kind of handing off, and Jim and Derek will be taking over, and we may end up running back some of our coverage at that point and just trying to focus on GP, and we've got, you know, Andy and Dave focusing on BSB, and maybe trying to just make sure we get things taken care of without stressing ourselves too thin without Superbike, Moto America, so on and so forth. We will see. But anyway, don't forget, you can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. That's facebook.com/motopod. If you want to find us on Facebook, that is our Motopod fan page. You can get over there and throw us a like. Check for updates. We're also on Twitter @moto_pod. We have a bit of banter over there. I myself, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at SkylarV28. Jim, where can people find you?
@MotoRGV on Instagram and Twitter.
Excellent. And we have a whole bunch of other hosts with a whole bunch of other screen names. They will tell you all about them when they were on this show as well. Jim, what did we say at the beginning of the show? Let's try to knock this out in an hour. And then we laughed at ourselves and said, well, we'll try. And then it just doesn't
happen. Not when the racing's that good, it's not going to happen. That's for sure.
All right. Well, hey, man, you get some rest. I'm going to go cool off because it's like gotten back up to the 80s here and the nights are warm again. So, and this room is just hot as hell. So anyway, bye, man. All right. Good talking to you.
We'll talk to everybody after Barcelona.
That's right. Stay tuned, and I will see you guys sometime in July.